by canoe and dog train among the Cree and Salt Tooth Indians by the Reverend Egerton R. Young. Chapter 1. Gather the harvest in, the fields are white, and long ago ye heard, ringing across the world the Master's word, leave no such fruitage to the Lord of sin, gather the harvest in. The question of evangelizing the Indians, tribes of North America, is one that has been more or less prominent before the Christian churches for many years. In the prosecution of this work, some of the noblest of God's heroes have been engaged. Some of the greatest hardships and sufferings have been endured, and some of the grandest trophies have been won. It is to be regretted that Indian missionary biography is so limited, but few are the abiding records in book form of those men of heroic mold who have devoted themselves to this department of missionary toil. While we rejoice that we had the biographies of Elliot, Brainerd, and a few others of the early missionaries who so nobly toiled, and not in vain, among the swarthy red men of the forest, we cannot but regret that so little has been published of such Indian missionaries as Evans, Rundle, McDougall, Steinher, and others whose daring, patience, endurance, and successful toil would make their biographies as thrillingly interesting and as valuable to the church as those of Carey, Judson, Hunt, or Morrison. These missionaries to the Aborigines of the American continent deserve all the more credit from the fact that their lives and energies were devoted to the benefit of what is generally considered a vanishing people, a dying race. For the Indians, in too many instances, the gospel of bullets has been preached more loudly than the gospel of love. More laws have been enacted to legislate him out of existence than to lift him up into the condition of a loyal citizenship and the enjoyment of a consistent Christianity. Very humiliating is the fact that there are in these so-called Christian lands many who, forgetting the doctrine of the universal brotherhood of humanity and also that of the universality of the atonement, have become so dwarfed and prejudiced in their minds concerning the red man as to leave him completely outside the pale of humanity and utterly beyond the reach of God's mercy, and with dogmatic assurance have declared that the only good Indian is the dead Indian. Or, as it was once brutally expressed to me by a military officer, Indians are vermin fit only for extermination. It is a cause of thankfulness that while ignorance or terror or ambition or greed have caused too many to have such views, many others have differed and have gone to work to do the Indians good. And their lives have not been complete failures. Apart from the efforts made by the priests who accompanied Cortes, Pizarro, and other military adventurers very early in the 16th century, priests were laboring in Florida and in the Rio Grande country for the conversion of the natives, and they counted their converts by thousands long before any considerable settlement of English-speaking people had been formed on the continent. Thus, in the following century, the story of the labors and hardships of the Jesuits and other organizations of the Church of Rome among the Hurons of Canada, the Iroquois of New York, the Abenakis of Maine, and various other tribes, as narrated in the eloquent pages of Parkman's Fascinating Histories, is more like a thrilling romance than as a sober recital of actual facts. In the first settlements in Maryland, the conversion of the Indians was a subject that at once attracted attention, and the laborers did not toil in vain. In the charter given to the band of adventurers who, in the year 1607, fixed upon Virginia as their home, these words occur. They were ordered to use all proper means to draw the savage and heathen people to the true knowledge and service of God. Within a year after the arrival of the Pilgrim Fathers at Plymouth Rock, one of the elders, a Mr. Cushman, in writing back to his friends in England, referred to the tractable disposition of the Indian youth and the philosophy of doing them much good, and the possibility of doing them much good. Those grand and sturdy people who, for conscience sake, had come out into the wilderness had themselves declared that they had come to America for weighty and solid reasons, among which was this, that they might be used for the propagation and advancing of the gospel and kingdom of Christ. In their conscientious way, they set about the fulfillment of these designs. Of the wonderful revivals among the Indians under the labors of the Reverends David and John Brainerd, a good deal has been written. Their consecrated zeal and great successes fired anew the hearts of such glorious men as the Wesleys, Whitfield, and Jonathan Edwards. An eminent writer has declared that the work of God among the Indians at that period was perhaps without parallel in heathen missions since the days of the apostles. David Brainerd, in writing of the wondrous work, said, "The power of God seemed to descend upon the Indians like a mighty rushing wind, with the astonishing energy bore down all before it. Marvelous were the results. Old men and women were in deep distress for their souls, and the most stubborn hearts were compelled to bow, and thousands were happily converted to God." So deeply impressed was John Wesley with Brainerd's work among the Indians that we find in the fifth volume of his works the following question and answer. Question: what can be done in order to revive the work of God where it is decayed? Answer: let every preacher read carefully over the life of David Brainerd, etc. To follow and record with any degree of completeness the work carried on by the churches among these wards of the nations would be interesting and a labor of love, but it would occupy volumes. Suffice it to say, ere we begin to make fuller mention of the Canada work, of which we have some personal knowledge, that the churches of the United States are carrying on a grand enterprise with increasing vigor and encouraging success. Excellent schools like those at Carlisle in Pennsylvania and Hampton Institute in Virginia are developing noble Christian men and women who are giving fresh impetus to the blessed work of lifting up these remnants of once mighty tribes to the enjoyment of true religion and to a higher plane of civilization. It is also an encouraging sign of the times that the government of the mightiest republic the world ever saw is waking up to its responsibility, and as if to atone for the misdeeds of its agents and the sad blunders of the past, is entering on a new career resolved that justice, although long delayed, shall yet be meted out to its Indian subjects. The blood and iron policy was a disgrace to American civilization and to our common Christianity. The effort to make the Indian decent by force has been a complete failure. The force of honest, straightforward example will do vastly more. By right thinking people, General Grant deserves ever to be held in the common remembrance of for his peace policy. When so-called friends urged him to make a change in it, his reply was characteristic of the man and worthy to be remembered. If the present policy towards Indians can be improved in any way, I will always be ready to receive suggestions on the subject. I do not believe our Creator ever placed different races of men on this earth with a view to have the stronger exert all his energies in the extermination of the weaker. If any change takes place in the Indian policy of the government while I hold my present office, it will be on the humanitarian side of the question.